I think the thing that really struck me in that project was that there was this tool, in that case, a general linear model, which I'll come to in a minute, which was really, really useful. So it was useful in a specific context, which was about estimating the frequencies of multiple sinusoids in noise. But it was also useful in all kinds of other things. And that ability to take one hammer and apply it to multiple nails really struck a chord. It struck a chord to such a degree that I declined Bill's offer of doing a PhD and decided to jump ship into industry, where I worked for a company, an organisation that became Kinetic. So it started Kinetic life, at least when I was there, as DERO, which was part of the UK Ministry of Defence, that then migrated into a commercial entity, Kinetic. So I worked full-time for DERO/Kinetic from 1999 to 2012, full-time PhD student here at the same time between 2001 and 2004, and then by about 2010, I became what Kinetic refers to as a technical manager. So they have a team of 130 people doing data analytics, basically. So that's everything from the PhD to text processing or whatever. That team has a line manager who worries about things like money, and it has a technical manager who worries about things like how on earth we're going to do it. So I was the kind of technical conscience for that team. What I hadn't realised, and I said for this subject on hearing Peter talking, is my tactic for winning funding was to figure out how to do it, probably do most of it, and then apply for the funding to go and be paid to do it, at which point you accumulate the next solution to the next problem, which you then go on to deliver. I don't know if that's subliminal, but it's certainly true. Funding had got a bit frustrating with the existence I had in Kinetic, at least, where I could see how to solve problems, but I couldn't actually win the funding to do what is now kind of EPSRC's domain in terms of low-tier research. So I jumped ship to University of Liverpool. I assumed prior to the interaction with Liverpool that I wouldn't be able to become a professor. Also saw where I get a handout paper wrong. But started as a professor in 2013. Because I moved from industry, I started with no PhD students, no postdocs, no USB sticks, no pieces of paper, no books, nothing. So it's either liberating or petrifying, depending on which day of the week it is. I currently have 4 PhD students and 2 postdocs funded, with another 3 PhD students and 2 postdocs in various stages of recruitment. And I'm looking at problems that span image processing, tracking and surveillance, information fusion, decision support, text analytics, machine learning, for applications that span bioinformatics, pharmacovigilance, which I'll explain what that is a bit, robotics, cybersecurity, aerospace, physical surveillance, transport, blah, 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 blah. So I'd love to think that I could do something that attempts to mirror some of the achievements that we've achieved. I suppose I'm trying to live up to what he demonstrated was possible when I was a PhD student and the interaction I had with him. So there's an interesting aside, which is that I never realised there was any alternative to PhD. Yeah? So I don't know whether that's unusual for everybody in the room, but when I was taught all this signal processing stuff, the only way to think about the world was based on this. And then I wandered into some conference, I can't remember what it was, but I met some lady who had this thing called Frequentist take on life, and it was just baffling. So I don't know whether that means that I was too indoctrinated, but certainly my kind of mindset about how to tackle all of this stuff is very lazy. So I'm going to try to explain a few hammers, and then I'm going to try to explain a few nails. I'm conscious that there are a mix of people in the audience, so I'm going to try and do this at multiple levels simultaneously. Either will work or fail, actually. So I will both try to convey some mathematical meat for those of you that are hungry for ideas, at the same time as conveying some kind of high-level stuff to those of you that are confused by the equations. But yeah, the spirit of what Phil did, let us go, that was an equation. There is a thing called the general linear model. It basically says that your data is a sum of basis functions plus noise. So what that means is that if you've got your data, you can think of it as some noise, but then plus one thing you're interested in, plus another thing you're interested in, plus another thing you're interested in. And what you don't know is how many things of interest are there, where they are, what they are, and all this kind of stuff. But it gives you a framework for describing that kind of problem. So you can wrap some maps around it, and learn some stuff in visualization if you want. So you can do something a bit more useful, which is to say, we don't want to be prescriptive about the models we use, but we do want to be explicit about the fact we are using models. So I guess the mindset is that you're trying to say that there is an explicit assumption that you don't know very much at the start, and then somebody's going to come along with some data and going to figure out some stuff. But it turns out that if you take this starting point and you turn a Bayesian crank, you end up with an equation that looks a bit like this. And what that essentially means is that from this standpoint, the world isn't Gaussian, it's kind of student T, you think. But more crucially, this model turns out to be remarkably flexible for analysing and describing data sets. So I've used it for sinusoids, I've used it for acoustics, and I've used it for looking at transport data related to pressures on optical fibres. So things that span all kinds of different domains. It's the same bit of mathematics, just reused and templated across in different domains. I don't know, but the person that I think of when I think of this model is Bill. Yeah? So whether it was him who really popularised it, whether it was just him who popularised it to me, I don't know. But the point is, I think of that and Bill as being very similar. Number two. We have a target density pi. We want to generate samples of the target density, so we draw samples from something else that we call Q, and we accept them with a probability that's some ratio of pi's and Q's. Okay? And it turns out, and this is just kind of completely incredible to me, that if you follow that relatively simple recipe, and you turn the handle, and you keep on going, and keep on going, and keep on going, you generate samples from this thing pi. So, for those of you who understand, this is kind of teaching you psychics. For those of you who haven't heard of this before, the real point is that you've got this pi thing that you really want samples from, and you can generate samples from it without generating samples from it, which is just kind of incredible. So, if you could generate samples from it by this magic process that happens to be called MCMC, then you can go and ask all kinds of interesting questions that you're interested in. And that's for any pi. So for any problem that you can pose as one involving a probability density, we can use this particular hammer. The specification of this is called good sample simulated annealing. But we have a hammer for batch problems. So if you give me a massive data set in any domain, I can use this hammer and I can convert your knowledge about how the data comes about into an estimate of what that tells me about what I'm interested in. And interestingly, in the third year project that I kind of started out by describing, I didn't quite invent give something, because somebody's done that a while ago. But I reinvented something that looked a bit like give sampling, and I think that's possibly what sparked Bill's interest in interacting with me, because I felt like I was trying to develop something, and it turned out that it already existed, but it was quite an interesting intellectual journey. Anyway, so we have a second hammer, which is the ability to solve batch problems. Okay, so same particle filters. Now we have a different kind of problem. We have a problem where time evolves, okay? And as time evolves, we get more and more data coming in, and we want to keep track of whatever it is that we're looking at. So that might be an aeroplane flying through the sky, you have measurements from a radar, and you want to be able to figure out where the aeroplane is. It might be financial stocks, it might be something completely different, but there's a kind of template for the problem formulation. And as Philip has said before, we can guess from something else, Q, and it turns out that if we can guess, we can make the samples look like they solve the problem we're interested in. So we deliberately solve the wrong problem, but then we make the answers look like something that we're interested in. So this has again this remarkable property that you can tackle the problem you're interested in without tackling the problem you're interested in. And again, that kind of, to me, kind of just totally opens up the world in terms of the ability to take problems, apply these kind of techniques and derive benefit. Anyway, there's a technical detail. But the real point is that we now have a hammer for dynamic problems. So remember, we have a hammer for posing problems, we have a hammer for static problems, and now we have a hammer for dynamic problems. So this is looking like a pretty good toolbox. More recently, some of the people involved in the talk that Peter just gave, particularly Arne Dixe, have been involved in this thing called sequential Monte Carlo samplings. So these are kind of similar to particle filters, but they're dramatically more general framework. So so this is kind of similar to MCMC as well. So we want to have samples from pi, we draw samples from Q, and we use important sampling now to essentially come up with something that represents or enables us to represent the problem we're interested in. So why is this a useful thing? Well, this is a useful thing because, again, pi is the thing we want to tackle, but now we can have multiple guesses at pi over multiple iterations. So we can have a population of samples, and we can use a population of samples to tackle a problem that we can pose but we can't solve. Some detail. But the point is that this gives you a much better hammer for static and dynamic problems. I probably should have got some screwdriver into that. If you imagine that you've got your MCMC and your particle filter in your toolbox, and then suddenly this SMC sampler thing comes in, it gives you a really elevated capacity to tackle problems that you haven't realized. So that toolbox, again, I kind of attribute the content to either people that emerged from Bill's group or Bill himself. To give you an idea of the kinds of problems I'm tackling at the moment, I'm interested in things like tracking people through CCTV networks. So if you have a London's worth of CCTV, how do you follow, assuming that you can sort out all data protection issues, is an assumption. How would you go about building a scalable solution that could track everybody through all cameras for all time? So work your back. It turns out that one particularly thorny sub-issue is being able to track lots of people in the kind of Oxford Street scenario where they walk in front of one another. But it turns out that there are techniques that you can take from computer science, again, kind of slightly unnerving mirroring of stories that have already been told. So I found techniques in the computer science literature, I found techniques in statistics, and I found techniques in particle physics, which it turns out when you combine them together enable you to do a much better job than anybody seems to think you can in tracking everybody's tracking people through CCTV. There's a center called Argus. So the US military have basically put 384 mobile phone cameras on the bottom helicopter generates 2 gigapixels a second, something like that. It is rumoured that they need to use 60 people to analyse each sensor's data because the automated processing isn't up to it, which is dumb, right? So, so let's not do that. Yep, so we're working on that. It turns out it's also awkward to access the real data because it's only been flown in Afghanistan. We're a bit anxious about that. So we built the simulator of the data as well, which turns out to be quite useful. I'm also looking at bioinformatics, so finding biomarkers, doing some work on very efficient sampling in high dimensions, looking at how to do particle filters at scale on a Hadoop or Spark cluster, looking at very efficient use of cool data sets. So this is quite a fun one. So if you go and talk to the particle physics people, right, they tell you how they've built nothing going to be tolerated underneath some part of the earth, right? And they track these small particles around, and they hope they crash into one another in just the right way. Okay? And then they go, oh, damn it, let's do it again. And they do that again and again and again and again and again. And they get a data point. And then they do it again and again and again and again, and they get a data point. And they do it again and again. So, and eventually, they get of order 6, 7, 8 data points. And they then, because they're particle physicists, they've done loads of maths. They thought, well, how can we do a really good job with a really small data set? And essentially, they came up with a dramatically better way of taking the average of numbers. So you and I might think, if I had 6 numbers and I was to add them up, the best thing I could do is add them all up and divide by 6. You'd be wrong. The best thing you can do is work out the derivative of a log PDF from which the numbers were sampled and add up the 6 essentially estimators derived from the log derivative, which is kind of like adding up 6 guesses rather than 6 numbers to derive 1 guess. So it turns out that you only get with a Gaussian you only get to machine precision accuracy of your mean with 6 samples. So it's actually the floating point arithmetic that holds you back. In general, you get about 10,000 improvement in estimation accuracy. So I mean, it's just awesome. So they've done that in particle physics, but they've written it in such crazy notation that nobody has a chance in hell of being able to understand it. So meanwhile, the clinical trials people are saying, oh gosh, it's terribly bad that we need all this data. But of course, they haven't been trained in the same mathematics as the particle physics people. So they're just going on collecting enormous data sets to try to find the 6 people that have got a particular rare genetic disorder that means that they're prone to a certain thing. So, wouldn't it be really cool to take the particle physics stuff and translate it into their clinical trials? There's also, I was talking to some people recently about image geospatial analytics. So, it turns out that big data works until it stops working, and these people have just bumped into when it doesn't work. I did some work whilst I was at Kinetic on how to solve that problem, so hopefully we can get some funding to essentially build what you can think of as a petabyte and upscale geospatial data set. And there's deep learning as well, something I'm looking at across the time. So there's a whole load of problems kind of facing the future that we can go and tackle. I'm just going to focus on 3 which are in the past, present and future with respect to my research trajectory, if you like. So very quickly, biologists and chemists often analyse spectra. Depending on which flavour of biologists and chemists you're talking to, it might be mass spectrometry, it might be ROM, it might be IR, it might be NMR, and I've interacted with people on all those fronts. They have to care about 2 things primarily, sensitivity and resolution, and they basically have 2 kinds of tools they can use at the moment. There are tools that are really, really fast, but rubbish. And there are tools, predominantly used in STMC, which have been demonstrated at a statistical level but they're too slow to be practical to be able to be used, for example, as the back end of some processing chain coupled to an actual spectrometer. So we want to combine performance with efficiency. Now, hopefully you remember the sonic screwdriver hammer. Yeah. So what we've done is we've taken the general Lilly model, we've added a few bells and whistles, which aren't particularly important for this discussion. Our basic functions turn out to be noise-free, neat, and they're provided, and this is a key point, provided by sensor manufacturers. So there is a mindset in, I attribute it to computer science, where you try to partition up your historic work into a box that you put on the shelf, and then you build the next box by integrating the things that are on the shelf. And the problem with that mindset is that it's really easy to forget how the boxes work. And it also means that you can be prone, I think, to not going off and talking to the people that actually understand how the world works, or how the data was generated, and using their understanding to inform how you're building lots of stuff together. So the advantage of kind of thinking about things in a Bayesian way, as I see it, one of many advantages, is that you can factor in the design of the sensor in how you analyse the data. But what that does is it means you respect the sensor manufacturer, you believe they have something to offer to your, the performance of your algorithm. And whilst it might help the algorithm, it also helps the adoption, because if you go to the person that's building the sensor and you say, can you help me make your sensor better, they'll be much more receptive than you going to them saying, I've got a silver bullet that will be able to do better than you ever tried before, which can come across as a bit narrowing. Generally model, we use SNC sample for optimizing the parameters. Here's some example data, so mass, go this way, yeah. So you can see the intensity gain up page. The raw data is the blue line, which is noisy, and it turns out we want to estimate the peaks. I can't remember exactly what this is, it's volume in data. Conventional methods get really thrown off by the fact there's loads of noise. You can use these general limit models to be able to figure out that the first peak is roughly the black shade of the second, or a combination of two peaks is the red and the red coat. So why would you want to do that? Turns out it gives you better resolution of nearby peaks, which they get very excited about. Gives you much better performance in noise, which they get actually quite excited about, and more interesting resolution, I think, because you can achieve the same benefit in terms of sensitivity by just integrating for longer, but to get the same benefit in terms of resolution require a new sensor, which is much more expensive to measure for the first bullet than the second bullet. And the SNC sampler is much faster than MCMC, so there's a technical point for those of you in the audience that haven't triggered this yet. I think, I think it might be wrong, that MCMC couples how you represent the uncertainty with how you navigate the space. You're an outlier with respect to some density over here. You're so paranoid about not being able to get back that even if you've got a really carefully constructed proposal density that jumps to the top of the peak, you kind of go, oh, I don't want to go there, I don't want to go there, because I can never get back again. And conversely, an SMC sampler can kind of just go, and it jumps straight to the top of the peak, which turns out to be really, really efficient, particularly when you've got very peaky densities, which is typically the case in these kinds of scenarios. Okay, so pharmacovigilance, nail 2. Okay, so this is an active EU funding project. I should have said actually the spectral analysis thing is actually something that I looked at as part of my PhD with Bill and a guy called Sirard, I think his first name was, who's another one of my PhD students. So, context switch, pharmacovigilance. Basically drug safety. So what you want to do, so the way it works at the moment is if you take your aspirin and you get a tummy ache because you take the aspirin, you go to the doctor and the doctor fills in a form online, goes off to the NHRA in London and tells them that yet another patient has had a dodgy reaction to this particular new kind of aspirin, and then the new kind of aspirin packaging essentially would be changed to say, if you've got diabetes, don't take the aspirin. I'm completely guessing about this, just no idea about the connection between aspirin and diabetes. But meanwhile, the social media sort of side of the planet has been reporting the fact that drugs have side effects for much longer time. So you could have potentially recalled the drug earlier, saving both the potentially the lives of people who have very much these side effects of the new drug, and the expense of the drug company who has to spend an awful lot of money recalling the drugs. So what you want to do is to augment and improve existing systems for drug safety. It turns out that basically the problem boils down to designing a classifier. So there are two mindsets for designing classifiers. The first is a kind of statistician's mindset, which says we must be robust. We absolutely must be robust. So we'll fit a density to our data, and then the density will tell us everything we want. The other mindset is a computer science mindset, which says it's all about decision boundaries. We just need to pick the best decision boundary. Yeah? Tell me about your robustness later, but I'm going to give you a decision boundary. Okay? And these two communities both accept that the other exists in the kind of same way that you might accept that the other person you're talking to exists, but you're not going to pay lip service to their existence. You don't really listen to what they say. So it turns out as well that you can actually synergize the two mindsets by thinking about the world slightly differently. So apologies for those of you not wanting to see equations. You can think of a classifier as something that optimizes a cost function, and the cost function you want to optimize is one that is essentially the expected performance in the future. And conventionally what you do is you say, I've got a training set, I can use my training set, the performance on the training set, to be able to approximate this cost function that we'd like to have. Okay, so that's the first one. But it turns out that you could come up with a better estimate by thinking of the world in terms of importance of something, which happens to be something that underpins particle filters and SMC samples. And if you do that, you get an equation that looks kind of the same, these two lines are kind of the same, except you've got this term here. And what this term here does is it says, upweight the importance of points that are near the decision boundary, which is exactly what your support vector machine advocate would have said. But you've come at that conclusion by essentially spotting that your cost function can be reformulated in fact as a lower variance estimator of the thing you really like. And if you do that, in terms of your handles, you end up with a synergistic approach, which which gives you better performance on a fixed amount of training data, and it gives you two special cases, each of which is what the statistician and the computer scientist would have advocated, except that those special cases hardly ever happen, and the cases that actually populate the planet we live on somewhere in the middle. Okay, and then very finally, in the future, a particular thing that I'm interested in is something to do with making robots that can navigate without GPS. There's a technique called SLAM which exists to do that. The important thing is that SLAM is an example of a problem which there aren't theoretical papers on. So there's a gap in the literature. If you go and talk to all those Christos of the world, and you, Del as well, and you say, why isn't there a set of proofs for why we can tackle these particular kinds of problems? It turns out, they say, well, shouldn't do that. And then you say, well, actually, it turns out all these people in engineering are doing it already. They're actually building cars to drive around the planet. using that technology, and the statisticians are like, would you do that, yes, they would. But it turns out that you can fix it. So you can fix it by taking the carbon footprint, it turns out, in metrics and replacing it with the SMC sampler. And the possibilities of work that they've got often use somewhere to get to dark through it to say that what this enables you to do is to have reduced requirements on sensors so you can get away with cheaper cars, cheaper sensors for your autonomous cars. But it's more interesting not as something that's better at solving today's problem, but wouldn't it be amazing if we had a worldwide atlas that dynamically evolved in real time and enabled us to see from anywhere in any direction so that you could actually not just live in a virtual world, you could live in this world but wherever you wanted to be. Maybe that's a bit Star Trek, but it'd be difficult if you could do it. Slightly over budget, never mind. Bill played a pivotal role, I believe, in popularizing some powerful basic tools, which I call utility. The general image model is a flexible sort of problem specification tool. Monte Carlo methods are a flexible way of solving problems. I tried to make this point softly, but I'll make it more kind of overtly now. I believe that Bayesian statistics is really successful because it respects the domain expert. It says that the prior is important, and the people that know about the prior are the people that understand the problem space and are not statisticians. I think that people put a bit of lip service on this interdisciplinary level, but I think it can really benefit from that kind of mindset. So if I was going to point at what Bill's legacy was, I would say that we can hope to inspire a fraction as many people to a fraction of the same degree, and I think